from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on Capital Notes, we'll talk about Wisconsin's latest state budget, which Governor Tony Evers signed earlier this month.
The budget he signed still has a net balance of about $750 million. There's some money there in case we have costs from the reconciliation bill or other things by the feds do.
We'll talk to the author of a book about must-see attractions and experiences in Wisconsin. Plus, we'll learn about the making of the 1950 film Summer Stock, Judy Garland's last movie musical with MGM.
They put this script together, which Judy did not love. Gene Kelly certainly did not love. But they looked at it as something to get Judy back on her feet and back in front of the cameras.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. We'll start today's show with Capital Notes.
This is Capital Notes from Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Ayan Silver, speaking with J.R. Ross, editor of WisPolitics.com. Hi, J.R., thanks for joining me.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So I'd like to do a state budget and federal budget rewind. At 1:30 in the morning on July 3rd, Democratic Governor Tony Evers made his partial vetoes on the state budget. It was a rush to beat Congress's federal tax and spending bill. What was the Medicaid provider tax fix they needed to make? And first, can you explain what a Medicaid, which is also known as Badger Care in Wisconsin, what a Medicaid provider tax is?
So basically what the state has done, and many states do this, they take hospital patient revenues, and they place an assessment or a tax on those revenues. That money is then put into the matching funds formula with Medicaid, which then brings more federal dollars back to the state. The state then puts most of that money, not all of it, but most of it, back into hospitals. So hospitals pay a bit up front in this assessment. They get much more money back through the increased federal money to make it kind of a plus for them. And so the state's been doing that for a few years. And Governor Evers had proposed back in February increasing the assessment amount. So under federal law, pre-Big Beautiful Bill, the cap was 6%. You could go beyond that if you wanted to for the assessment, but you could only go up to 6% to get reimbursement from the feds or put it toward this formula. Wisconsin was at 1.8% previously. The governor proposed budget going to 5.7%. Then the deal that he struck with Republican lawmakers took it to 6, that maximum amount you could get reimbursement for. But the problem was they had to get that done and signed into law before the reconciliation bill took effect because they had new limits on those provider assessments that would have undercut the state's effort.
And so that's going to result in about approximately $1 billion a year in additional federal funding for Wisconsin. Is that not true?
For the hospitals, yes. And then the state's going to get a little bit of cut of that money too. So, you know, we have other programs with Medicaid that we're paying for, and they're using some of that increased federal money to cover the state's cost toward Medicaid.
And even with this fix that, you know, it was bipartisan, right? Because both the state, you know, Republicans in the legislature and Evers were on board with this.
Yes.
So even with this fix, there are estimates that the federal tax and spending legislation could cause over 275,000 people in Wisconsin to lose their health care. Is that what you're hearing?
So yeah, so there are various studies. So you have to separate the hospital assessment from other things, which, you know, there are new work requirements, for example, if you're on Medicaid, they're being implemented. Now, they don't take effect right away. I believe it comes down the road a little bit, but those new steps are believed to likely push some people off of the program.
And will these increased provider taxes, ultimately the hospitals are getting more money, but will the increased provider taxes cause people to pay more for their medical care?
That's not what's believed. They pay the same rate. It's just that you tax those revenues at a higher rate to get more money. The hospitals were totally behind this push, by the way. They actually have been shopping this idea to Republican lawmakers and the governor for a while, that they wanted this increase because they saw the opportunity for more revenues to come into Wisconsin to then benefit them.
And why did GOP Senate President Mary Felskowski have a bone to pick about this? She didn't sign on to the bipartisan budget because she said medical costs are too high and that people don't worry about the diagnoses, they worry about the costs. Wouldn't this be something that she would have gotten behind?
So she believes that hospitals have enough money as it is, that they are doing just fine, and that there needed to be, if you're going to do this, more reforms, more ways to rein in healthcare costs in Wisconsin. This budget not do enough to do that. Now, don't forget, Felskowski's in the insurance industry, and so they're also part of this entire deal, right, with healthcare costs. So she sees things from that perspective somewhat. So in talking to people about what she did, there's one, a belief that she philosophically has an issue with increasing the assessment for the additional revenue because she thinks it's not helping rein in healthcare costs. And two, you know, people wondering, what does she want to do next? I know she probably has some true philosophical beliefs about this, but in politics, everybody has a question, what are you up to whenever you make a move like this? No Senate president in the history of Wisconsin had voted against a budget until Felskowski did last week. So that's how unusual that move was. So people have talked about, you know, she mentions possible candidate for governor, possible for Congress, you know, that has been kicked around out there. So if Tom Tiffany runs for governor, then maybe she gets in the race for the 7th Congressional District. So people are wondering what she wants to do because, again, such an unusual move that has people wondering if there's another motivation behind it besides her belief that this is not good for Wisconsin.
And how does the federal tax and spending bill, or the Wisconsin budget for that matter, affect rural healthcare infrastructure in Wisconsin?
Well, you know, that's going to be interesting to see how this money comes in from the assessment and where it goes out. I haven't seen actual breakdowns by hospital yet. We'll see how that all plays out. But there are some things that are going to be interesting to watch because the hospitals will tell you that they are struggling in rural areas of Wisconsin. That, you know, we have a couple close, I believe, especially in the Eau Claire area a year or two ago, if I remember correctly. So there are definitely some strains on the system. And that's just a question. Does this going to do enough to kind of put them in good shape going forward?
You're tuned into Capital Notes. I'm WEWM's Mayan Silver, speaking with J.R. Ross, editor of WisPolitics.com. Okay, we've been talking about Medicaid and the impact of the changes that state legislators and the governor made in Wisconsin, but also just Medicaid cuts overall. There's also Wisconsin's SNAP program, which is also known as Food Share. It's Supplemental Nutrition Assistance. Do we know anything about how the federal reconciliation bill will affect that in Wisconsin?
I've seen various estimates of what it's going to cost. One interesting to note is that the budget the governor signed has a pretty healthy cushion. Remember, we had a $4.3 billion surplus projected for the end of the biennium of June 30th. The budget he signed still has a net balance about $750 million at the end of the fiscal year 26-27. So there's some money there in case we have costs from the reconciliation bill or other things by the feds do, they have to cover. Also, it's a decent cushion for the state in case the economy goes south for some reason. And then third, whoever's in charge come 2027 could have a good chunk of change to begin to build his or her next budget. So three options that are pretty good because of that money being there in the general fund or projected to be there.
And now that the reconciliation bill is in, do you think that Wisconsin lawmakers are going to have to go back into the budget or amend anything or rework anything, or since it was happening so simultaneously?
Good question. That's, again, why I say that cushion that we have projected to have of $750 million roughly, that's a nice thing to have in the bank just in case things go south. So they've got some breathing room if things go differently than what they expect right now.
And as part of the state budget, Evers cut taxes deeper than he wanted to, and the GOP spent more on childcare and education than they wanted to. You've said that. What was the funding for childcare in this budget? Is it childcare counts? Is it not? Can you explain to people what the childcare portion is and who accesses it?
Sure. It's not officially childcare counts, but it looks an awful lot like how childcare counts operated. Remember, Evers used federal COVID-19 funds to pump money in that system where they basically provided direct subsidies to childcare centers to help them, you know, boost pay or, you know, do what they need to do to stay open, those kinds of things. So now what they're doing is, instead of using federal COVID money, there is interest off that money. It's kind of a deep in the weeds, but when you have money, you put it into accounts that draw interest, right? The government does the same thing. And so there's about $170 million or so in interest off those funds that the governor had argued he should control. Lawmakers said they should control that money. In the end, they're using it to pay for various things in this budget, including these subsidies that look a lot like child care accounts, though it's not called child care accounts. So they're finding a way to keep that system going. And then there are a number of other, you know, changes that are kind of a mix of Republican ideas on, for example, you know, how old you have to be an assistant teacher, I think, in a center, certifications for large family centers. There's things they pushed for. Those are in the budget now. So there's a blend of what each side wanted, but that had been a red line for the governor. He absolutely said he had to have some kind of child care package to sign the budget, and he got it.
How does that affect, like, your average parent in Wisconsin? Like, are there income levels for who can qualify for these? I mean, or since they're giving the money directly to child care agencies, it's just overall serving to make the price of child care lower in the state. How is it working?
It's a mix of everything. So, for example, we have a system right now in Wisconsin that if you are kind of qualified as the working poor, you can go get subsidies directly from the state to help cover the cost of your child care. Now, what they do is they say, okay, you live in region X. We're going to set the help at X percentile of what it costs for a child care slot. They're raising that voucher, essentially, to cover the 75th percentile. So if you live in, let's just say, Sheboygan, that area, they're going to look at all the child care centers in your area and say, okay, for a kid who's X age, it costs this much on average to take care of them. Well, we're going to make that voucher cover 75% of the available slots in your neck of the woods. So not every place, but 75% of them. And so they boosted it to that level. So that helps those with the working poor get those. You've got the direct subsidies through the, you know, it looks like child care account system, the mix of other things Republicans wanted. So it's a multifaceted approach trying to attack that issue and make it more affordable. Now, child care providers, you're going to get a mixed reaction. They're going to say they need more. This is not enough. At least some of them are going to say that, but there's a lot more than what they would have gotten without the governor making that a red line in the budget.
And what now for the Capitol? There's going to be a summer recess. What are you looking for over the next few months and when lawmakers reconvene?
If they do anything. I don't mean to be flippant, but getting this budget through was a Herculean task. There are definitely some not great feelings left over from this process about how it went. Senate Republicans are a little bit unhappy when, you know, Felskowski is a member of leadership and she voted against the budget. That just doesn't happen. Again, first Senate president ever to vote against the budget. There's that. So there's people are just kind of had a very difficult spring and early summer to get this thing done. They haven't the most productive legislature I've ever seen. People don't expect them to be terribly productive this fall either, just because a lot of what they can get done got done in that budget. Now there's other things that they will do for sure. There's messaging stuff that, you know, both sides are going to push. But as far as like actually getting a big thing done, they got most of the big things done already for the session.
Maybe a lame duck rest of 2025.
It could be fairly quiet. And the question is in 2026, how long do they meet before they go to the campaign trail? Because, you know, as we've talked about before, control of both houses of the legislature is at stake. Governor Evers has announced he's going to run for third term yet. Republicans are lining up to jump in that race. So there's a lot at stake next year, and they got to kind of get ready for it.
All right. Well, as always, thanks for the insights, JR, and thanks for joining me on Capitol Notes.
Oh, anytime.
Just like Capitol Notes, Lake Effect is also a podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. Coming up, we'll talk to the author of 100 Things to Do in Wisconsin Before You Die. But first, we'll hear about a documentary that tells the story of Milwaukee's Brady Street. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. A documentary screening at Milwaukee's Oriental Theater this week explores the city's historic Brady Street neighborhood, from its earliest roots to present day, and its eras of immigration.
And very quickly, by the early 50s, this neighborhood became an Italian neighborhood, flipped it, and it almost, for the most part, became known as the Little Italy of Milwaukee.
Brady Street Portrait of a Neighborhood was made over the course of 2 years by more than 80 UW-Milwaukee film students and directed by Sean Kafer. He joins Lake Effect's Excret Nunez to talk about the making of the documentary.
For people who live outside the Milwaukee area and aren't familiar with Brady Street, can you introduce us to it?
Yeah, I think I'd like to say that Brady Street might be something different to everybody. It's widely known for its nightlife, really good food, restaurants. But yeah, it's a place that has a rich history and a Polish population and the Italian population that moved there at a certain time. And then also for the counterculture that it was really well known for in the 60s, 70s, and even still kind of today.
Right. And in this documentary, the story of Brady Street is told through historians, neighborhood residents, and various business owners in the area. I'm curious, how did you and your students build out the blueprint of where to start with Brady Street's story and who the sources would be?
I love that question. We just started off with Frank Aliotto, who was a historian and wrote a book about the neighborhood. And from there, we asked him who to talk to, and we reached out to other people. We kind of kept letting it grow. We would ask maybe about two people that we could talk to, and we see it was kind of just let it grow further and further and further, and we didn't have a blueprint. And going into it right away, we knew that we didn't, but there were some important people that were given to us through the Business Improvement District also. So I think my favorite part about it is that it grew organically without a game plan going into it.
Yeah, and I think that almost makes it even more authentic. And in the documentary, you focus on various immigrant communities at different points in Milwaukee's history, including Polish immigrants. It was interesting for me to learn how they built foundational parts of the city. Can you talk about the early Polish era in the Brady Street area?
Yeah, the Polish population came when the tanneries came. So a number of tanneries are lined up on the river where we see apartment houses and condos now. And at the time, the cheap labor was the Polish immigrant, but that was the group at the time period that you could pay less, and they would work at the industry and the leather industry there. And how they came and built their houses up was they took a lot of recycled materials from different parts of town, brought it over, and eventually you create a really small house, and then maybe you'd build up and put brick around the bottom, and that would be your Polish flat that we now know today. And that they also might, instead of having a backyard, they might put another house in the back, and maybe that was the parents' house or another family member's place. So it's a very condensed neighborhood with all of its Polish flats, and you can't always see the backyards, but the backyards might have one or two houses back there.
Yes, very family-oriented, and it was interesting, too, to learn about, you know, the Polish immigrants were a very hard-working community and that their religion meant so much to them that they built the St. Hedwig Church.
Yeah, that's correct. Beautiful church. I think it was a smaller church at first, but then over time, as more funds were collected, they got to build the beautiful St. Hedwig's. Before that, Frank Aliotto shares with us that they would make a pilgrimage all the way down to the south side, St. Stanislaus, I think, which they were walking to. So that's like maybe, I don't know, 4 or 5 miles. But doing that every Sunday is a pilgrimage. And then coming back, like you're making an event all day long just to try to get to church. So it was essential for them to build this. And it's now kind of like the center of the street.
And another group you focus on is Italian immigrants in Milwaukee. You spoke with some people who were there in the 1940s and 50s. What are some of the stories you heard from people who moved straight from Sicily to Wisconsin?
Yeah, well, one of the first places that they occupied was they'd come to the Third Ward and then kind of worked their way up to the Brady Street area and started a lot of businesses. You might find a lot of Italian delis, grocery stores, markets, and whatnot. But I think it's fascinating. We get to learn that, especially in Sicily, most of the Italian population that come here are from Sicily, but we do talk to somebody, Rosalia, who's from mainland Italy. But there was not much industry, especially in Sicily. I know Mima Orlando shares with us that it's either fishing or something else, and there's not much. So you come here because there's industry, so you can make some money to raise a family. And we get to hear about Mima coming, actually being a child bride, which I think is an important story for us to hear. And remember, that's how people came here that way. And this is a part for history we want to keep inside of our documents and our books.
Right. And it was definitely an emotional moment in the documentary. And there are also a few turning points in the film. But one that really stood out to me was Brady Street's history in the 70s and 80s, a time where a lot of businesses closed and people weren't on the street for good reasons. Can you talk about this rise and this fall?
Yeah, it's interesting because it's all shared with people that had businesses on the street or were really close to a part of this neighborhood at this time. And from my understanding, what we get to learn in the film is, well, Brady Street Festival stops happening. Brady Street Fest at one point in the 70s was a pretty raucous, pretty wild thing, you know. Not everybody loved hippies, people getting drunk, and when we hear peeing in the yard a lot or just like sleeping in the yard, and like a lot of the residents didn't like that. So an older person stops it. But when the people didn't have a place to go anymore, it became kind of like a ghost town. A lot of the windows would be boarded up. Different people try to come in there and rehabilitate the neighborhood. And there's some wins and there's some losses in there. But it takes almost 20 years for it to really to grow again. But it takes this time where rent is cheap in the street because it's not a very desired street anymore. So people get to experiment and come in there and try something out that's kind of different. Where we have our Mima Orlando comes in there, builds this Italian restaurant. I think she says there's 3 or 4 tables. And then by the end, I can't remember how many she had because it became like a banquet kind of place also. But this allows other people to come in and experiment. It also makes the neighborhood rich as it evolves, and you have different cultures coming in, and you know, we'll have like a Thai restaurant come in, and we have the Diplomat, which is a James Beard awarding restaurant. We have a Brazilian coffee shop, and we still have our Italian bakery or delis too, and our old pizza place like Zaffiro's. But these kind of rehabilitations in neighborhoods allow other groups and different people to come in, and kind of makes it that rich neighborhood that it is.
Something that really struck me when watching the documentary is that all of the people you spoke to felt so passionate about how living and working in Brady Street has meant so much to their lives. Why do you think that is?
I think it's the connection that people see each other and they know each other. Again, I didn't necessarily go to the bar life when I first came to Milwaukee, but it'd be the coffee shops on Brady Street. And like I would get to meet people and people would say hi. You don't necessarily know the names, but you start feeling like a part of the community. And I think the students along the way started feeling that same thing too. They maybe had interviewed someone and they'd see that person and there'd be connections there. And now they felt like they're part of the community. But it's people maybe that don't know each other like best friends, but they know each other, and there's something warm about that. And I think that's why a lot of times we like to come back to our urban settings so we feel like a part of a community, which is a good feeling.
Absolutely. And someone who kind of ties the whole story together for me is Mark Denning, who is enrolled with the Oneida Tribe of Wisconsin and a cultural speaker and educator with UW-Milwaukee. Can you talk about how he establishes the evolution of Brady Street?
I think he's essential to the film because we often think of our history of just European settlers coming in, but we have to remember that there were people here for tens of thousands of years before that. And he reminds us of what different native tribes, how they used the land and the water and how important it was and how it was this meeting place, because we have this confluence of three rivers where trade and agriculture and fishing can all happen. So he brings it together and kind of gives us a beginning of what it was like. And I don't want to say too much about the end, but I'll say that he gives a positive outlook for Milwaukee and the rivers and the environment.
Definitely. And you've already shown the film a couple of times, maybe with the community. What has been the initial reaction from people?
Well, we've only shown clips so far, so we actually haven't even had a full a lot of way the announcements go out. It sounds like we're showing the whole film, but we've just been given teasers so far. But the responses have been really great. I think the very first time we showed it with a couple of the business improvement district members, one person, I remember crying because it touched her so much, a person that had grown up in the neighborhood and is a business owner in the neighborhood still. I think it's going to touch a lot of people. And then some people say, hey, you know, you left out that three-legged dog that everybody knew 100 years ago. Why are there these small things? But yeah, we're always going to miss some of those things, but that's for the residents to remember, and that's important. But I think people that have maybe been in this neighborhood 40 years ago, 50 years ago, or maybe even 10 years ago are going to come back and see like, oh my gosh, that's why it felt like maybe I couldn't articulate why it felt like such a special place. But now seeing it and hearing the stories, maybe now I understand.
Yeah, and I think people too, maybe that have lived here or are new to Milwaukee, like myself, I just feel a little more appreciative of the Brady Street neighborhood after watching this documentary. And, you know, this was a long-running project in the making for you and your students. What do you think the more than 80 students who worked on production took away from making this documentary?
Well, I think they took away, first off, they got to learn how to be on a real production. And for many of them, if not most of them, if not all of them, this might be their first real big-time production that they're doing. So getting to work together, but then also becoming part of the neighborhood. A lot of our students at UW-Milwaukee, we have a very rich and diverse student body, but many of them come from places that are maybe not as condensed and urban as this. So getting into these neighborhoods and feeling these kind of connections, I could see it in the students and like in their face and in their eyes and in their smile that they're connecting with the community and they liked it.
Well, Sean, thank you so much for speaking with me today and sharing this project with me.
Hey, it's been my pleasure.
Sean Kafer is the program director of Doc UWM and director of Brady Street, Portrait of a Neighborhood. He spoke with Lake Effect's Excret Nunez in spring. You can see the film this Thursday at 6:30 at the Oriental Theater. If you're looking for new ways to experience Wisconsin, a local writer's book covers just that. Danelle Gay is the author of 100 Things to Do in Wisconsin Before You Die. In her book, Gay details places to visit like Heritage Hill in Green Bay and festivals to attend like Elmwood's UFO Days. WUWM's Eddie Morales talked to Gay about her statewide adventures.
You've been writing about travel for more than a decade. What did you do before writing, and what led to the creation of your latest book, which is 100 Things to Do in Wisconsin Before You Die?
So before this, I had a restaurant and a catering company with my mom for about 10 years in Sun Prairie, Wisconsin. So as a professional chef, that kind of ties in nicely as I travel and checking out restaurants and the different, you know, kind of fun ways that people play with food. This book came along during COVID, you know, when the world shut down. I reached out to my friend Sarah, who's co-owner of the Midwest Travel Network, and I said, you know, I'm stuck in Wisconsin, you're stuck in Iowa, we have friends in Nebraska, Illinois, all of these places. What if together we wrote a book and we did it on the highways and byways of our states? We did a road trip book. So we did. The 12 of us got together. We wrote a road trip book that hit the bestseller list in the middle of a global pandemic when nobody was traveling. And then everybody started to notice us because more than 40% of our peers had quit. So different publishers started reaching out, and I got this contract from Reedy Press. And I was like, yes, I want to do this. And I had an idea of exactly how I was going to do it. Then I went to our governor's conference on tourism and totally changed how I ended up doing the book.
How did that change?
Well, I didn't want it to be a list of places you could just Google. But I learned at the governor's conference that we got less COVID tourism relief dollars than other Midwest states. So I shifted my list and focused more on mom and pop places, living history museums, nonprofits, things like that, that if we weren't going to see as much money from the federal government, we probably wouldn't see as much from the state. I thought maybe I could be a COVID tourism, you know, relief fund. And besides getting people into these places, as I've been doing book signing events around the state of Wisconsin, I've been donating profits back then to those same nonprofits, food pantries, veterans groups, even public libraries.
And the first thing that's listed in the book is eat at a Wisconsin supper club like Cantafio's Buckhorn Steakhouse. Can you tell me about your experiences there and how that place honors veterans?
We have almost 300 supper clubs in Wisconsin, and they run the gambit from the very rough, like just right out of post, you know, prohibition, what you would experience, all the way up to luxury experiences. Cantafio's, it's kind of mid-range. I mean, you're going to see the wood paneling. They'll have fried frog legs on the menu. Incredible people, but they're a Gold Star family. They lost their son, Ryan, almost 20 years ago. They do free meals for veterans, and then they do different other things to help support the community too. It's kind of like a living honorarium to Ryan. So It's really a neat place, and they're incredible people.
There are a lot of things to do in this book that I discovered by reading it, like Elmwood's UFO Days Festival and the Airbnb at the Wisconsin Maritime Museum. What was your process for creating the list, and what did you discover when creating it?
I knew a lot of places on the perimeter of the state from doing the road trip book where I covered like the Great River Road, Door County Coastal Byway. I really worked with different tourism organizations, chambers of commerce, convention and visitor bureaus in the middle of the state to find other things that kind of fit what I was looking for. So partnering with some of the different destinations to get ideas, as well as asking my readers, because they're a great source. So many people go places I haven't. Some people help to bring ideas to my list. But yeah, things like we have three UFO festivals. So Elmwood's UFO Festival is the longest running. So things that are fun, things that help create memories, and things that support different, you know, neighbors and communities within our own state. I really talk about agricultural tourism in the book. We lose one family farm in Wisconsin a day. So there's many ways we can support it just besides going to that farmer's market. If you eat farm to fork, and I talk about that in the book, eating farm to fork at a restaurant that locally supports 10 to 15 different farmers to get their produce and their meat and their cheese and all of that, that really makes a difference to supporting your communities, as well as doing those goofy things like putting on the wader, standing out in that cranberry bog like the Ocean Spray guy, or even things like goat yoga, going to the pumpkin patches, the corn mazes. All of these are things that we can do to help support our Wisconsin farmers.
How difficult was it to narrow the list down to just 100?
Oof. I mean, I could have written a book, 1,000 things to do easily. So it was balancing things throughout the state, considering different times of the year, and then everyone from families with little kids to the empty nesters, you know, trying to create a mix that touches a little bit of everybody.
The book is divided by sections like food and drink and music and entertainment. The culture and history section is the largest in the book. Was that intentional?
I touch a little bit in the introduction about my mom and how she would make everything an adventure. She would always hear people say, oh, wait until the kids are older. And she'd be like, no, there's never a better time than now. Everything can be fun and a learning experience. That's what she taught me. And especially if you have kids, I mean, you can go there and then you can go there the very next season or the very next year, and they'll pick up something entirely different. So we are so blessed in Wisconsin with all the different ethnic groups and the different industries. We had logging and mining and fishing, so many different things. It's amazing what you can actually learn here, but yet still have fun when you do it.
Is there anything that stands out to you specifically that when you visited like a certain museum or a certain cultural aspect of something that's on the list that really is profound, that you learned something? I'm sure there's a lot, but is there anything that at this moment sticks out?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, in Milwaukee, we were at America's Black Holocaust Museum. I took my teenager and their best friend, who is Black. And so two teenagers for an hour and a half, incredibly quiet. I've never seen them that quiet. It was an incredible experience. It's very well done, from pre-African slave trade all the way up to President Obama. And the conversations that were started in the car on the way home were incredible. So that was very profound to me. And then the very first picture in the book is a young Mr. Murphy in Green Bay at Heritage Hill. He's wearing a uniform, was working at the fort, and he had just raised the flag and was saluting it. And so at 16, he's one of the three of the Murphy kids that works there now. But it made me realize that was the average age for almost the last 300 years in this area of our soldiers, a 16-year-old kid. And so I think that's an incredibly powerful picture. That was one of my favorite in the whole book.
And you mentioned that you write about your mom, and the book is dedicated to your mom and your family. How did your family, from your upbringing and up to your home today, how did they contribute to the creation of this book?
So the seeds that my mom planted in my head, and then being a parent myself who has a kid that loves to learn, going out, experiencing different things, we were kind of like weekend road trip warriors, you know. It'd be like, what are we going to go look for today? Or what do we want to try this time? Or always have to try something new, experiment and have fun. So being able to try and pull something like that together as a list for other people to literally just check stuff off as they go, that was going to be a fun experience and challenge.
Thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it, Danelle.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm going to get on that old
turnpike and I'm going to ride. Danelle Gay is the author of 100 Things to Do in Wisconsin Before You Die. She spoke with WUWM's Eddie Morales when her book came out in 2023. We've got a new season of Bubbler Talk going, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Coming up, we'll learn about the making of the musical Summer Stock and why one local author thinks it's worth bringing back into the spotlight. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers.
Forget your troubles, come on, get happy. You better chase all your cares away.
That is Judy Garland singing Get Happy. While this song is famous in the Garland songbook, the movie it came from isn't as well known. Get Happy is the closing number of the 1950 MGM musical Summer Stock, starring Judy Garland and Gene Kelly. Despite coming from a production company known for churning out musicals, the film isn't listed alongside other classic musicals Garland and Kelly were known for. A book called Come On, Get Happy, The Making of Summer Stock, studies the motion picture. David Fantle is the co-author of the book and joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to talk about the film.
Your book has been 40 years in the making. So to start, why Summer Stock and what about it has kept you so invested all these years?
Well, the love of the Hollywood musical goes back even more than 40 years for me and my co-writer Tom Johnson. So when we were teenagers, and like many people saw That's Entertainment in 1974, we were 15 years old, we got hooked on musicals from that point on and really have never looked back. When you say 40 years in the making, I mean, rolling up the sleeves and the hard work for this book was a good 4 years, the past 4 years, but you're right. We were fortunate as college journalists back at the University of Minnesota to have what you might call tenacity, pluck, chutzpah, nerve, whatever, to actually go to Los Angeles as college journalists. And we're fortunate in 1978, at the age of 18, to have green-lit meetings with Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly.
Amazing.
Yeah. And, you know, when you meet Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly, and they're so universally revered, it opened the door to dozens or actually hundreds of more Golden Age stars that we were fortunate enough to meet. And during those meetings, it included two visits with Gene Kelly, a visit with Harry Warren, the three-time Academy Award composer, who was the principal songwriter of Summer Stock, Eddie Bracken, who has a really fun supporting role as the sort of neurotic fiancé of the Judy Garland character, as well as Charles Walters, sort of the unheralded great director of these MGM musicals who directed Summer Stock. Now, our interviews and our meetings 40 plus years ago weren't strictly pointed at talking about Summer Stock because we didn't know at that time that 40 some years later we'd actually write a book. But we did ask questions about it. And fortunately, we retained tapes and notes and other things and were able to include those primary research interviews into our book.
What do you think it is about Summer Stock that's made it been overlooked in the history of all the musical canons that we think about, especially in film? Like even the hardcore musical fans maybe aren't as familiar with it or they kind of dismiss it.
I think the plot probably is what people dismiss the most because the plot, arguably, or admittedly, I could say, is not really advancing the art of the film musical. It was looked at as a little bit of a throwback to the Judy Garland, Mickey Rooney, hey, let's put a show on in the barn kind of things that they were doing about 10 years ago. But at this point in Judy's career, this was 1949 when they started production, you know, Judy's career was a little bit rocky. I mean, and again, she had a marriage that was all but over with director Vincent Minnelli. She had a growing addiction to prescription medications. She had a three-year-old toddler to care for, Liza Minnelli. So a lot of things were working against Judy at the time. And so they put this script together, which Judy did not love. Gene Kelly certainly did not love. But they looked at it as something to get Judy back on her feet and back in front of the cameras.
Yeah, so let's explain the plot briefly here. There's a barn dance.
Yeah, right.
Stuff happens in a barn.
So, you know, Judy plays a strong, independent woman, and I think that is overlooked a bit when you think about Summerstock. But essentially, she plays a Connecticut farm owner who loses her hired hands, and she's faced with bringing in her crops all by herself or with little to no help other than a tractor, which seems to have an ongoing role in this plot right. of the film. And all of a sudden, her ambitious younger sister, Abigail, played by Gloria DeHaven, decides to bring a troupe of aspiring actors to their barn to stage a barnyard musical that was really directed by the Gene Kelly character who plays Joe Ross. So it is a variation on let's put a show on in the barn musical. And the last several minutes of this film is devoted to what we call a show within a movie. Mm-hmm. And that is all of the different musical scenes.
That number after number.
Number after number. And of course, it ends on an incredible high note with the iconic Judy Garland number, Get Happy.
Right. So people are probably more familiar with the closing song, Get Happy, than they are the movie that it came from. So let's talk about some of the factors that brought this movie to be. MGM was pretty much considered the studio for musical movies. So what factors were playing within this studio that led up and drove this film's production, despite the leads maybe not liking the script and other things that kind of complicated its production?
Well, Summerstock was just on the slate of planned productions. I mean, MGM and all the major studios at that time were still factories. That's what they were doing. They were self-contained factories that were churning out 30 to 50 feature films each. And as early as December 1948, the Hollywood Trades announced that Summerstock would be a future production at MGM Studios and produced by Joe Pasternak. So Summerstock was just another production in the factory system at MGM. It went before the cameras in late 1949. Gene and Judy weren't hip on the, really too thrilled about the script itself, but they all managed to overcome that and really churn out a really fun, enjoyable entertainment. And when we don't talk about it in the same breath as some of the other musicals we just mentioned, I will make the case, and I hope the book does, and if you watch the film, it makes the case that for 109 minutes, there is some incredibly entertaining musical numbers if you look beyond the script. Now, I'm not going to mention the Phil Silvers, Gene Kelly, Heavenly Music number as one of them. But Gene Kelly's personal favorite tap dance solo, which he does with a squeaky floorboard and an old newspaper, is his personal favorite tap dance that he did in any of his movies. We have Judy Garland's Get Happy, which is on the short list of anyone's favorite Judy Garland film numbers. You have the Portland Fancy, which is probably, of the three films that Kelly and Garland made together, is the best dance number that those two do together. It's a tap solo in the barn. It's sort of like an old-style challenge dance. Like we use the analogy of Annie, Get Your Gun. Anything you can do, I can do better. Kelly does a move, Judy can meet that move and does it. There's an overlooked ballad, sort of the style, you could say, of Over the Rainbow, and that's called Friendly Star. And it's a very lovely number. It never really had legs beyond Summerstock, probably because it was upstaged by Get Happy. And there's the Dig for Your Dinner, which is sort of like a weird Southern revivalist kind of thing. Again, Phil Silvers, a little over the top with his shtick. But Gene Kelly does an amazing tap number. And Kelly works so beautifully with tap dancing in really confined spaces. And I think the Dig for Your Dinner number is a perfect example of that.
So Gene Kelly and Judy Garland, they're, of course, the star power behind this. They've worked together over their careers. Can you share a bit about what Judy Garland and Gene Kelly's careers were at this point? You mentioned Judy's troubles with prescription, what do we want to call
medications,
them? Medication.
Yeah,
right. They called them energy pills,
yeah,
right?
Right.
But they also had a great working relationship together, despite whatever the project was they had. Like, when they were together, it was something special.
Well, Gene and Judy started, well, Gene's first film was 1942. It was For Me and My Gal, and it starred Judy Garland. And Judy Garland, after Wizard of Oz in 39, was sort of money in the bank at MGM throughout the 1940s. But Gene loved Judy and always felt that he was indebted to her, because Gene came from the stage, Pal Joey in particular, and he was used to projecting to the third balcony. Judy helped him in 1942 for that film sort of tone it down and how to really act in front of the camera. They didn't work together again until 1948. They made an ambitious film that is sort of a cult classic today called The Pirate. And then they reteamed again. They started in 49 for the 1950 release of Summer Stock. Gene Kelly's career was on the ascension. He was an A-lister by this time. Immediately after Summer Stock wrapped, he went into another landmark musical, An American in Paris, which won a Best Picture Academy Award. So Gene was on the ascension, and Judy was having more and more issues. While Gene wasn't thrilled with the plot of Summer Stock, he knew, and the studio knew, that they needed to surround Judy Garland with people that were friends of hers and people that she trusted. So that being said, they brought in Chuck Walters, who had directed Judy in Easter Parade in 1948, Gene Kelly, Eddie Bracken, Gloria DeHaven, Phil Silvers. What did they do? They acted as this giant security blanket around Judy. They protected Judy and helped bring her over the finish line to complete the Summer Stock production.
So this book also addresses some key myths you heard about the making of this film that you dove a little deeper into with your research. What were those ones that you wanted to dispel to kind of bring this movie up in, you know, public opinion?
I think most people think that the long production and the problems that this production was beset with was solely the fault of Judy Garland, her absences, her growing problems. And that is entirely not true. Did she come late? Yes. Did she miss some days of production? Certainly. But there were other factors. By December of 1949, they realized they had only 5 songs. They realized that the 5 songs were not going to carry them over the finish line. What does that mean? That means they had to write, compose, orchestrate, record, and film new numbers. That extended the length of the film production time. The other myth is that people think that the last thing filmed was Judy Garland's number, Get Happy. Some even think that it was a film number she had filmed for a previous film and it was cut and they inserted it and edited it into Summer Stock. All myths. Get Happy was shot only a couple weeks after Judy wrapped her initial production. They brought her back. She personally selected Get Happy. Chuck Walters beautifully choreographed and filmed it, and it was done. But the other thing is, it was not the last number shot for the film. The last number that was actually shot for the film was Gene Kelly's squeaky board newspaper solo dance. So if anything, we want to make it clear that Judy Garland was not the sole reason the film took 6 months to complete.
Yeah. With MGM right now, currently, it's no longer an independent studio. It long ago lost its status as a powerhouse studio as the film business has changed, you know, since that heyday of musical production. But what do you want readers to learn and appreciate about Summer Stock over 70 years later?
Well, that it still has some of the best numbers, musical, and it's one of the last great tap dance musicals. Yeah, with Singing in the Rain, there were still some tap dance numbers to come and musicals to come, but we think it's one of the last great tap dance musicals. And again, in 109 minutes, I think you're going to see more show-stopping numbers than many of the more well-known musicals of that era. And you're exactly right. The studio system by 1950 was changing dramatically, and we really write about that. Louis B. Mayer, the head of the benevolent, I say that in air quotes, head of the studio since 1924, since its inception, was almost on the way out. Dorie Sherry, a younger, more progressive filmmaker, was on the way in. He was the head of production. TV was encroaching. We had the Hollywood blacklist that was taking place at the time. We had the studios, the monopoly that the studios had with their distribution of films and owning theaters being broken up by the federal government. So the whole grasp that the studio system had for the previous 20 years was starting to crumble. And we talk about the circumstances in which Summerstock was made during 49 and 1950.
Well, David, thank you so much for coming in to talk more about Summerstock. And if anyone's interested and hasn't seen it, PSA, it is available to watch on YouTube for free. So
that's right.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Audrey.
David Fantel is the co-author of Come On, Get Happy, The Making of Summer Stock. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in 2023. Summer Stock will be shown on 35mm film at Milwaukee's Oriental Theater this Wednesday at 6:30. Fantel and co-author Tom Johnson will be there for a book signing and Q&A after the film. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. The Republican National Convention was in town 1 year ago. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll look at what the economic impact has been. Thanks so much for joining us right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
If you can see me from afar, won't you?